I'm Ian Golden, the director of the Oxford Martin School, which is an interdisciplinary community in Oxford, part of the university, focusing on the big challenges of the future.
Great. In your recent book, Globalization for Development, Meeting New Challenges, you explore the relationship between the various processes of globalization and economic development. Can you briefly detail your findings?
What the evidence shows is that globalization has made the most remarkable contribution to human progress. And by globalization, I mean integration and connectivity, the coming down of walls between societies and increasing flows of ideas primarily between them, but also technological flows, people flows, financial flows, trade flows, and service flows. And that coming together has enabled people to escape poverty at a more rapid rate than ever in history. It has also brought new potential, new ideas like ideas of democracy, ideas of human rights, ideas of women's rights and equality, ideas of the elimination of bads like child labour, and many other things have spread through this coming together. So it's a period of most remarkable progress. At the same time, we need to be very conscious of the fact that it has been associated with two really serious Achilles heels, two downsides to globalization, and these need to be properly managed. The first is that not all flows are good. And how one opens up, the pace at which one opens up, the sequencing at which one opens up, and what one brings in and what one doesn't bring in is absolutely critical to society's future. So just as, for example, in trade reform, one doesn't overnight reduce one's tariffs to allow one's workers to be subject to global competitive pressures, so one shouldn't equally in finance, one needs some form of controls, and so one shouldn't in other areas, and I even don't recommend opening one's borders totally for migration, although I do see that as a very good thing in the longer term. So how one manages that is really crucial, and what the book is really about is that, and particularly how one manages that for poverty reduction. So I think it's very important that while we embrace connectivity and openness, we don't naively just think that, well, that means we just open up and integrate. So one problem has been the lack of policy coherence, lack of understanding, lack of coordination around these issues and the lessons learnt that one should make from experiences around the world. The second issue is that globalization has been associated with growing inequality. And there are really two reasons for that. The first is what you might say is that people aren't globalized enough in the sense that they're not connected enough. This is people living in geographies which are geographically isolated, like the Sahel, where they don't have the hardware, the infrastructure, the roads, the transport, the telecommunications, the digital connectivity, the broadband, the systems that enable them to benefit from globalization. They're isolated. The other side of this is they don't have the software. They don't have the institutions. They don't have the education systems, the health systems, and the judicial systems, the governance systems, which enable them to live in a society which benefits. And you might have societies, and there are many societies, which are actually extremely connected and globalized, but only for the elite. A small group of people have captured the benefits of globalization. This often happens in countries which are just exporting oil, for example, or minerals. A very small group take it. And the consequence of this has been growing inequality within countries and between countries. And that is a crucial problem. And unless we deal with it and ensure that globalization is more inclusive, people will reject it, as indeed they are, around the world. And this is, I think, because we have not allowed globalization to be a force for development. And that's why I call the book Globalization for Underlining or Italicizing for Development. It can be a force for development, but it can also be a force for growing inequality and lack of development if it's not properly managed. So one issue is ensuring that we support governments through giving more attention to the infrastructure which is required for more effective globalization, but also we think about the reforms that are necessary, the policy changes that are necessary to ensure that a broader part of the population benefits. So that's one big issue on globalization, which is its inclusiveness. The second big issue is systemic risk, which is that when you open your door, wonderful things come through, and people, but also some very dangerous things which can be highly destabilizing for your society. Pandemics, financial crises, terrorists, cyber attacks, and so forth. And so the biggest challenge in that is how to manage globalization to ensure that we are able to harvest the goods, but somehow keep out the bads. And if we can't do that, societies see globalization and integration as a threat, not an opportunity. So they see connectivity as not a vector of positive change, but of real damage. And we've seen that with the financial crisis, we see with pandemics, with cyber attacks, with terror. And the reaction of societies is to slam the doors, or try to slam the doors of globalization shut, becoming more xenophobic, nationalist, protectionist. That's very dangerous. And if we get into the cycle of deglobalization, which has happened in the past, the whole world is poorer. And it particularly is bad for poor people, because those that have not yet benefited from connectivity stand the most to gain, from the health advances or the jobs and the employment that will be created, and other benefits of connectivity. So it's really important that we understand systemic risk, and what I'm calling in a new book, the butterfly defect, which is bad things ripple really fast, and how we manage that. And that's really what the book is about. It's mainly focusing on the economic flows. It focuses on finance, on trade, on aid. I consider migration is key, and that's why there's a chapter on migration, there's a chapter on ideas, because I think ideas in the end are the most powerful driver of development, and indeed global policy is a journal about ideas in the end, and trying to spread those more widely and engage in debate around them. And then bring together policy recommendations.
So you've highlighted the sort of two major challenges of globalization, which is this increasing inequality and the systemic risk. What reforms do you think are necessary to the globalization processes you outlined that would remedy these challenges?
There are many, and you know, there's pages and pages of them in the book, of recommendations on policy reform. In each of the areas I look at specific reforms. On finance, I recommend that a much more nuanced understanding of capital account liberalization, a better balancing between different sources of financing for countries that are not relying entirely on capital market bond flows, for example, but also equity and other investment. I advocate very strongly the need for broadening and deepening the financial market to include microfinance, small and medium scale finance, etc., and the role that international institutions could play in this. There's a big issue around democratization of the issue of the institutions of international finance as well, and that's really relates to my concerns about the World Bank in part, but also about its key areas that it's going to be effective as a knowledge on this and other areas, knowledge bank. So finance, a whole series of things. Trade, it really remains one of the biggest global scandals, that the rich world subsidizes its agriculture to the tune of about $250 billion a year, which is highly destabilizing for world food prices and frustrates the opportunity of poor people in poor countries to grow food and export food. So the perverse subsidies in agriculture are a great concern of mine. They're environmentally highly destructive as well, and I have a case for rapid reform of that. There's also a great need in trade to ensure that many of the reforms which have been talked about in the context of the Doha development round are manifest. It's meant to be a development round. It's just stuck in the mire at the moment. It was started a decade ago, and it still hasn't made progress, and most people think it won't. So that's a real tragedy, because I believe there's real opportunity if it's done properly. Of course, not all trade, like not all finance or other things, are good flows. There's a lot of illicit trade. There's a need for much stricter regulation of arms, for example, of people, particularly child labor and others, narcotics, drugs. So what I also talk about those sorts of flows as well, and how they may be better managed. And then facilitation issues, allowing countries to trade. There's a very big issue about diversification, allowing countries to get out of their commodity dependence, and that's partly again about the import policies and the crazy subsidies in the rich countries, but not only. On aid, I push for more aid and more effective aid. The rich countries, in terms of a broad sweep of time, have never been richer, and developing countries have never been better managed. And it really is a scandal, therefore, as well, that we haven't been able to honour our commitments that we made 40 years ago, when we were much, much poorer than we were now, to devote 0.7% of our income to aid. All the evidence is that since particularly the end of the Cold War, the geopolitics of aid and the geopolitical determination has diminished, and aid is increasingly going to where poor people are. That's obviously a key thing if you want aid to be effective. And it needs to go more to where poor people are. It needs to be going to projects that they would be supportive of. There have been massive scandals in the past of wasted aid, but that's much less so. Part of the benefit of the Millennium Development Goals and shared goalposts on aid with the MDGs has been that we all play or should be playing the same game now, understanding what we're doing. But that does imply that acting as a team, that we lose some attribution, that we can't go and put our flags on our individual projects. We need to get behind government's projects and work collectively, although accountability remains absolutely key. That needs to be worked through in the politics, and there's some evidence at the moment that we're slipping back. And of course, we also need to stop calling things like debt write-off for Iraq and geopolitical support for Colombia to overcome its problems as aid, because that is different. We really can't get back to a place where we're using aid budgets to further geopolitical needs for what are really often middle-income countries. So a lot said on aid, and obviously I've spent a lot of time, and again there's a lot to say about the institutions on aid. Migration is an area which, and in fact on many of these issues I've written other books which give a fuller account, but migration is an issue which I feel absolutely passionately about. It's always been the area which is most neglected. It's the orphan of the international system, no UN or organization for migration. It's always been the way that we've escaped poverty as a species. We've advanced because of migration, and people need to recognize that this has been the driver of development and of people escaping poverty. Closing the doors, which is a relatively recent phenomenon of the last 100 years, and making the walls higher and higher to migrants in a period of innovation when the other walls are coming down, is a terrible irony and tragedy, particularly for the poor people trapped in poverty and trapped in environments where they have no future, or a very dangerous future, but also because we are losing the potential of the benefits of those people coming to our society. So I believe strongly that the fact that's going to determine the future of Europe is going to be its migration policy, for example. This has proved itself true in the US. It's not something which is necessarily news, but if we do come to that recognition, then it has very strong implications for the way that we run migration policy. Obviously, brain gain, brain waste, remittances, all of these things are issues I deal with as well. Ideas are the driver of development, as I said. And in ideas, there's much to be said. Firstly, how do you nurture the spread of ideas? And that's about communication. It's about overcoming the digital divide. It's about education, literacy, research networks, and many other things. And there's a lot of recommendations I have in those areas. But it's also about the intellectual property regime, patents, and questions regarding who has knowledge and what do you do with it, and can you lock it up? Or should you share it? And if you do lock it up, for how long? And does that increase innovation or not? And are there some things that you should allow intellectual property regimes to apply for, but not others, like you should allow them for the problems of rich diseases, but not, say, for neglected tropical diseases. And so those sort of debates are unpacked in the book, and I state my views on them, which is a much more environment, which is much more conducive towards helping developing countries get more rapid technological and other transfers. So a wide range of things. There are many things I don't talk about in the book, and it's necessarily a series of conversations about particularly economic flows and the areas that I feel I have some competence in. But I hope it helps overall create a more nuanced understanding of globalization and the sorts of things that we can do to make it more effective.
So you suggest a plethora of policy recommendations in all of these different areas, a lot of them very insightful and very innovative. I was just wondering how you envisage the process of these changes actually taking place, considering we live in an international framework in which the sovereign state is king and people don't want to have their vested interests muddled with. How do we overcome that in order to achieve these outcomes that you seem to think are so important?
Well, a key question is global governance. One of the real tensions that we're living through is that we've never been more globalized as a planet and more connected. And increasingly the issues that we need to deal with are between countries and way above the national state level or regional level. And yet the global governance system is totally unfit for 21st century purposes. And another book, which I've just finished this weekend actually, called Divided Nations, which OUP will also publish, is about that, why global governance has failed and what we can do about it. But it absolutely is the case that virtually every issue you think about, there needs to be a global architecture, certainly true of climate change, finance, migration, etc. There are in some areas institutions, like on finance, and the question which I do address in Divided Nations is how do you make these institutions more effective and accountable to get up to 21st century purposes? And then there's a question in areas where there aren't institutions, whether you can either adapt another institution, so the International Organization of Migration, for example, in the case of migration, not a UN institution, but could you make it one? What would that involve? And in climate change, where does responsibility lie and how are we going to do that? So you're absolutely right to point to the need for global institutions and rapid change, and we should spend a lot of our time, a lot more time than we do, worrying about that. Historically, global institutions have arisen out of crises, out of the ashes, and no doubt that will happen again in the future. But my hope is that we're wise enough and connected enough now to be able to preempt disaster and have institutions that we create proactively that stop terrible tragedies happening. That's the real question, is are we able to stop the tragedies happening, or will we just allow, as in the past, new institutions to supersede the existing ones out of the ashes? I hope we're wiser. But we should also not forget that a lot can be done at the national level and at the regional level, and we shouldn't push up and pass on to global institutions things that we can resolve elsewhere. So I believe very strongly in pushing down responsibility, and no global institution can be effective unless national institutions are effective. In the end, it's national governments that are going to be the decision makers at the global level. It's national governments that are going to implement, police, and affect change. And so without effective national governments, you can't have effective global institutions. Except if it's in a very narrow technical area. So air traffic control works well even over failed states. Okay, and that's because you can triage out of neighboring states the solution. You can't do that in many other areas. So it is important to also recognize that we shouldn't sort of cop out of our national responsibilities by saying, well, that's got to be resolved at the global level. Yes, there are many things that have to be, but we've also got to start at home.
So So you mentioned this is an area that needs more thought and consideration. I was just wondering what advice you would give to young practitioners and academics looking to enter the field of globalisation, development and thinking about social justice. What should they be focusing on? What can we do?
Well, it's a vast area and people must find what's meaningful in their own lives and their own communities in terms of where they can affect change, where they can contribute, because the remarkable thing is that we have this collective genius unlocked now. You know, everyone, we have a lot more geniuses in the world, that's wonderful. Hopefully they can help problem solving. But we're also connecting fragments of people's ideas and contributions in new ways that leads to collective problem solving capacity. And finding where one fits into that and how one can nurture it and further it. So not only you release your own energy towards the resolution of global problems, but release others in the process, and collectively that the sum is much bigger than the parts in your ability to solve problems, I think is absolutely central. And that's why I'm optimistic. I mean, when one looks at the problems of the world, and Oxford Martin School is all about identifying the issues and thinking about them, they legion and incredibly and increasingly complex, and that can be a bit overwhelming. But then you look at the brain power and the collective intelligence that's out there now, and you recognize that that's grown even more rapidly than the problems. And that's a source of immense optimism, if we can harness it correctly.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.